Thank you for coming. It's this week's installment in the continuing series of lectures sponsored by the Center for Russia, East Europe, and Central Asia, known to its devotees as CRECA. My name is David McDonald. I'm the chair and professor in the Department of History, where I specialize in the history of Imperial Russia, and it's my great pleasure to introduce my long-time friend and now colleague, Professor Alan Reed from the Department of Culture and Language Studies at the University of New Brunswick up in Fredericton, New Brunswick in eastern Canada. I think I'm pretty safe in saying that with the possible exception of either the Badger hockey team locker rooms, this is the only time that two natives of Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, or products of Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, have been in the same room together on this campus. Well, at least the Ag School might be a difference as well. Professor Reed and I were classmates together in a Russian language class from, the way we've seen it, is grade 9 through 12 at Evan Hardy Collegiate Institute in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, and it's strange to see which paths that class led down, but Professor Reed went on to continue his university education at the University of Saskatchewan, where he earned a bachelor's, followed by several years at Jagiellonian University, or Jagiellonian University in Kraków in Poland. He earned a master's at the University of Alberta with a thesis, and this was a true thesis master's, entitled Religion in Bulgakov's White Guard and the Master and Margarita, followed by a PhD at Alberta with a dissertation on literature, and literature is communication and cognition in Bakhtin and Lotman. This he subsequently turned into a monograph. He also held a postdoc at the Calgary Institute for the Humanities at the University of Calgary, which is, for those of you who are geographically disoriented, is south of Edmonton, but southwest of Saskatoon. He was hired by the University of New Brunswick in, when was that?
91.
Yeah, at a time of a dearth in jobs that some of us lead us to understand that today is not unique. And since that time, he has published widely in journals in Canada, in the United States, and most recently in Russia, on a variety of themes, including Bakhtin and Lotman, on various figures from the Holocaust as we experienced in the Polish and Ukrainian lands of Eastern Europe, and most recently on the subject that he'll be talking about today, the so-called dissident poet Natalia Garbanevskaya, active in Leningrad and Moscow in the 60s and 70s, and then later emigrated to Paris and now has settled in Warsaw. This research earned Reed a very prestigious and large grant from the Social Science and Humanities Research Council of Canada, their version of the ACLS, and he has conducted extensive research and published widely on this theme, and it's on that theme that he's going to speak today. And one of the great things about PowerPoint and visual representation is I don't have to remember the title because you've been looking at it while I've been speaking. So, saving you that redundancy, I'll simply cede the floor to Professor Reed, and thank you, Alan. Thanks for coming.
Thanks very much. So I'd like, first of all, to extend my thanks to Professor Tischler, who's been very patiently emailing back and forth with me and sometimes had to wait quite a while for a response, and to CRECA as well, and to David McDonald. And I don't know if any of you work with David or not, but if you need any stories or anything to get you through, you need any dirt on him, just get in touch. I'll fill you in on the backstory. It's also a good thing. Email's a good thing too, because I had trouble remembering what the actual title was, but I did find and that I just wanted to make sure that everyone caught the epigraph at the bottom, which is a line from one of Garbanevskaya's poems, and in some ways sort of captures some of what I'm going to try to communicate today. I assume that everyone knows something about Natalia Garbanevskaya, but I'll give a brief overview of her career just in case. And following that, I'll do a little bit of history in an attempt to trace some of the events and sources and people which may have been significant in some fashion in the development of her religious views. This is just a sketch and is in many respects speculative, since there is no real trail of evidence for some of the things that I'm going to try to stitch together, or not one that's certain anyway. And when I turn to the poems, I'll go through a number of them, beginning near the very beginning and of her career, and proceeding to recent times. Most of them coming sort of from the middle, but that's really just an arbitrary thing. I found some that I liked and that seemed to work for me. In doing so, I will highlight some of what I see as the recurrent features of this line in her work, and suggest that that she can, without a doubt, be described as a religious poet, or at least that religious concerns and beliefs are a central component of her oeuvre from start to finish, almost. And this is something which hasn't really been looked at very much at all. If some of you may be familiar with Daniel Weisbord, a former editor, longtime editor of Modern Poetry and Translation. And Daniel was the first translator of Gerbaniewska's poetry into English. He was also very active in the efforts to get her released from prison in the early 70s. And both he and his wife, who's also a scholar of Russian literature, great fans and supporters of Gerbaniewska. I interviewed him in, I think, 2004. And at the time, he was thinking of bring out a new volume of translations of her work, but he said to me something to the effect of, but there's all that religious stuff in it now. And of course, as it turns out, I haven't spoken to him since then, but he did talk to Gerbaniewska, and he has apparently decided to do that, which will be a great thing, because other than in various scattered places, there isn't a good systematic overview of her work in English. So he apparently has a contract and will be doing that, although he had some health problems, so I'm not quite sure. So let me turn to her biography. Her biography is of course, very very complicated. Of course, if I find that missing page, it will help too. There we go. In a conversation with Manouk Jajayan, poet and literary critic, one of her children famously said to him, "No, моя мама не только поэт." And of course, was an astute observation, was true of a lot of people, but in the case of Gerbaniewska, she said, really simultaneous and overlapping careers as a poet, a political activist, dissident, human rights activist, an editor, and a translator, among others. She was a leading presence in the human rights movement in the 1960s, beginning really at the very beginning of the 60s, and was a founding editor of the Chronicle of Current Events, and of hopefully some of you know what that is. Probably considered by a lot of people the most important single thing in the whole process that we now consider the dissident movement. And one of the handful of courageous and in some estimations foolhardy individuals who protested Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968, August 25th, and for which she was eventually imprisoned in a series of institutions, most notably the psychiatric prison in Kazan. Thanks to the work of a lot of people, both in the Soviet Union and in the West, Peter Redaway, Daniel Weisbord, Joan Baez, she was eventually released, but in the process became really a cause célèbre, both in the West and in the Soviet Union. Her face was on the cover of all sorts of major international publications, The Guardian and things like that. So she had quite a high profile in the early 70s especially. Lev Luria, whom I interviewed also in about 2004 at the time, had just been appointed the official historian of Petersburg, and who knew her. He's a generation younger than her, and he suggested that she was as famous as Elvis Presley at the time. I don't know whether we can take that entirely seriously or not, but she was pretty significant person. She immigrated in 75 under the kinds of difficult circumstances that most people did. At the end of 75, immediately went to Paris. Right away, she went to work, first of all, in the journal Continent, where she was very soon became the associate editor. There were three people that ran Continent: Vladimir Maximov, his wife Tanya Maximova, and Gerbaniewska. And the work was done, vast majority of the work was done by two people, Gerbanevskaya and Tanya Maksimova. And that's pretty well recognized. She was also assistant associate editor in Ruskaya Myslel for quite a number of years and worked for Radio Liberty as well. Among other things, she formed an important link between those two journals and the Polish journal Kultura, which is published in Paris, and was a link not only, she translating for them, both written and spoken. And that connection with Kultura, with its editors, who were also editors on the editorial board and among the key members of the editorial board of Continent, that relationship becomes essential for a number of other things. And that's an important aspect of her of the Polish part of her biography. I'll mention some aspects of it going back to the 50s afterwards, but in the period subsequent to her arrival in Paris, besides her involvement in Kultura, she became really the channel through which Russian speakers and to a considerable extent Russian readers, so that would be a lot of people in the West as well, were informed about events going on in Poland. That becomes particularly significant in the Solidarity period. She was very active in Solidarity, and for many people, for many Poles, was the central person in Paris during that period. She has been recognized in Poland for her contributions to Polish culture with a number of awards, most significantly probably the Jerzy Giedroyc Award, which is, I don't know what the equivalent would be for those of you that don't, but it's something to be quite proud of. A couple of years ago, she received an honorary doctorate from Lublin, and the last 3 years, I believe, she travels on a Polish passport. She still lives in Paris, but she refused to ask Russia to give her a passport. She said she didn't ask them to take the one that they took away from her, so she wasn't going to ask for a new one. And something makes her uncomfortable about the notion she likes living in Paris but doesn't want to be a French citizen. That's a whole other problem. But she approached the president of Poland to ask him face-to-face the way she would do it, sort of like that. Asked him for a passport, and he said certainly, and within a short time she had one. So that's quite important. All the news about Katyn, when it was coming out in the 80s, everything that went to Russia was primarily translated, went to Russian audiences, within Radio Liberty and other publications, went out through her, and a couple of other people, but she was the central person there, one at least of whom prefers to remain anonymous. One of her close friends. And I think she is also on the editorial board of a journal which has been being published for now it's getting on towards 15 years, Novaya Polsha, which is published by the successors of Jerzy Giedroyc, and is a journal devoted to improving communication between thinking people in Poland and Russian really plays an important role. Unfortunately, not enough people read it, probably, because it hasn't had maybe the effect that it should. But it's an important position she has there as well. So all this by way of establishing some of the contours of her life, some of which, I suppose, probably is not surprising that they're not as well known as they are. So if I talk a little bit about her career as a poet, she started around 1953. Of course, in 1953, she was writing poems on individual scraps of paper. She entered Moscow State University in 1953 as well, very important sort of intake that they had that year. Published in the Gazetas and in various Lita Objedinenia. But very soon she was actually became a relatively well-known new poet on the scene and moved in and out of various poetic groups, and one of the most important of which is the Chertkov Circle. And probably not many of you are familiar with the Chertkov Circle. I'm going to mention it a few times in the names Chertkov, Sergeyev, Krasavitsky, but it might sound like I'm trying to suggest that she was a member of the group, which she was not. It was a small group. but a lot of people moved in and out of it, small and very important in terms of its contribution to Russian culture of the time, and particularly poetic culture. She was involved in the very earliest joint efforts in Samizdat, publications like Syntaxis, Phoenix, and so on. And it's very difficult to get an answer from her about when and how her activities, both as a poet and as a dissident, began to merge. But at some point in the early 60s, they became, in some ways, a facet of two facets of the same thing. If we take Yuri Kublinovsky's word for it, Kublinovsky was a poet of the 60s, still writes and does literary criticism for Literaturna Gazeta and Novi Mir, I believe. He claims that in the mid-60s, the two poets whose poems were most widely read among students at MGU were Gorbanevskaya and Brodsky. He might be slightly unreliable. I think when he wrote that, he was romantically involved with her. But nevertheless, I think he did put his name under it, and I think it's significant. There are no records of things like that, of course. There's no, we can't say how many books, because there were no books being sold. Early in the 60s, she became involved with, among other groups, circle around Akhmatova, the so-called Akhmatova's orphans, and famously Akhmatova urged them to include her in their group. That's Brodsky, Nyman, Rain, and Bobyshev. They were all very good friends. Towards the end, they've ceased to be good friends. But at any rate, they decided not to. But she was very much a part of that group, good friends with Brodsky as well. She got kicked out of MGU and ended up later studying in Leningrad State University. She also spent a lot of time in in Tartu, and was interacted quite a bit with groups there. Her copy of Analyse by Tychicheva Tchekhta, which some of you know as one of Lotman's key works, says, Mayemu is inscribed by the author, by Lotman, Mayemu, Lyubimamu, Payatu, which I think is, again, quite significant. It says a lot about how widely read and appreciated she was at the time. So around the time of her arrest in 68, she wasn't the arrest kind of got extended after that, but she was published by Posyev in the West in a collection, and it was on that collection that Weisbord based his publications. He published some in journals before that, indexed in a couple other places. And after she immigrated in 75, she continued publishing in various journals, and regular small books of poetry came out. And the last full volume she published, 2006, and she has one waiting for publication now. She's still remarkably active. There are a variety of assessments of who she is as a poet, and I think a part of the story is to try to break that down just a little bit, but I don't want to spend much time. For some people, for example, you might mention Valentina Poluchina or Viktor Voroshilsky. They are most interested in her, they describe her unique lyrical voice and consider her a lyrical poet. For some, especially men of her readers from the beginning of the 60s, she is primarily a poet of civic themes, and I think there are some interesting examples of that amongst some of her former, say, colleagues in arms. For others, they seem to be most interested in her linguistic inventiveness and other sort of more formal aspects. And among those, I think it might be worth noting Lev Losyev, who died last year and was a great admirer of her poetry and a good friend as well, or Bakhit Kinjeev, another much younger poet who she was very instrumental in having him published early on, and a couple of young Russians, Dmitry Kuzmin. Some of you will know him as a poet and as an editor and publisher, and his younger colleague Danila Davidov. Another important aspect, another important way that she's looked at, is exemplified by the literary scholar Garik, or he also goes by George Levinton, who wrote a really interesting article in the late 70s, or in the 80s, sorry, on her and Brodsky. And he's most interested in the rich sort of fabric of literary and cultural allusions that she weaves into her poetry and how that represents sort of the language of the 1960s. And that's really, without that, I think probably for her one of the most important aspects of it as well. So I just sort of lay those things out there without saying very much about them, because of course I'm not going to talk about those things except a little bit incidentally. I'm going to try and make the case for considering her a religious poet, and except for a very brief article in a Russian religious periodical by a friend of hers, Galina Karnilova, who's an important literary figure herself, no one really has talked about Gorbanevskaya as a religious poet. So we'll see where it goes. A slightly different consideration of her as a religious persona is offered by the writer Lyudmila Ulitskaya. Some of you will know Ulitskaya. Ulitskaya and Gorbanevskaya have been close friends since the 60s, and their literary careers are also entwined in interesting ways that people are generally not aware of. But in her book, published in 2007, called Lyudi Nashego Tsaria, the last section of it, which she calls Poslednye, she has a very interesting story. I think you can call it a story, and I'm going to quote the beginning of it, and hopefully, I'm not going to try to explain it, I can't, but hopefully you can kind of try and hold it in your consciousness as we go through this, and some of it you'll remember, let me read it to you, and I'll just read it to you. Вот они сидят втроем и беседуют. Христос, Будда и Георгий Михайлович Гинзбург. А, собственно, о чем им говорить? Они сидят и улыбаются. А подойдет к ним отец Андрей, прекраснейший. Его не примут. Скажут, православных не берем. By the way, I didn't translate this because the style of it is part of the story. И католиков не берем. И мусульман не берем, тем более иудеев, только беспартийных. А примут кого? Слабоумную девочку Таню Князеву, Дауна Сашу Козлова и блаженную Наташу Горбаневскую. Ей православие простят, а умных никого. Я вдалеке постою. So that's Ulitskaya, who knows her better than most people, and her attempt to kind of situate her religiosity, of course, outside of the area of literature, but for her it's embodied in the literature as well. Hopefully you could understand my Russian and you can sort of think about that. So let me try and take you back to the question of religion in the context of the period in which Gorbanevskaya is being formed. And it's a difficult thing to try to trace. According to an interview from 1988, Brodsky stated that, quote, if I can be proud of myself as a poet, then only because already in one of my early poems I was the first in 40 years to use the word soul. He's referring to 1961 there. And didn't have in mind that the word had disappeared for 40 years, only that its usage had been hijacked and had not been employed in the sense of the Judeo-Christian soul or anima of idealistic philosophy. So, and of course, Brodsky as a religious thinker and a religious poet is an established topic. What one of the things that I want to sort of suggest is, and not in competitive terms, but Gorbanevskaya was 5 years before that already using religious motifs and the content of Christianity in some of her poetry. Possibly the only one doing it. They become friends around the same time that quote comes. So I also wanted to relay a quote or a story from Andrei Sergeyev's memoirs. And I don't know if you know Andrei Sergeyev, member of the Chertkov Circle, probably the foremost translator of English prose into Russian. and a good friend of Brodsky's, and he mentions in his memoirs that Brodsky was not taken, didn't have a particularly venomous temperament, I think would be the short version of what he wanted to say. But he talks about one time that he remembers when someone got under his skin and set him off. And the person in particular was a literary critic named Pinsky. I've never heard of, don't know who he is, doesn't probably matter. It was at dinner. And Pinsky said that something to the effect of, he wished that Akhmatova, Pasternak, and Zabolitsky had all been killed in 1929. That they didn't write anything important or interesting after that. And Brodsky apparently turned to him and said, and what were they writing about after 1929? A chom oni pisali. And Pinsky looked at him and said, and this is Sergeyev's shorthand, I guess. He said, a ya tak ne mogu. And Brodsky looked at him and said, a ya mogu, a bogye. And then it goes on from there. This is Brodsky filling in some of the context that it's important to sort of people like, in particular, Akhmatova and Pasternak are the carriers of the tradition, are the carriers of those values, are the carriers of those motifs and images. But we don't really know where they get picked up in a lot of cases. And so that's what that's about, I guess. So let me take you to 1968. I'm going to work backwards a little bit towards about 1955, and then we'll go to the poetry. 1968 was a busy year for Gurbanyevskaya. First of all, she was arrested. She wasn't actually arrested, but she was taken in for her participation during the demonstration in Red Square, August 25th, against the Czechoslovakia, against the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia. Her arrest was delayed until December 24th, 1969, because she had a four-month-old baby, who she took to the demonstration with her. The others were all beaten up and arrested, and they were imprisoned before her actual arrest and imprisonment. So that was August. She participated in the demonstration. End of April, she founded, as I mentioned before, and was continuously editing the Chronicle of Current Events. She was pregnant, carrying around her second child. She was a single mother and would continue to be a single mother, sort of on principle, as it were. Principle that I don't quite understand, and most people don't. She was briefly interned in a psychiatric institution somewhere in, I guess, February. And that process she described in a publication which came to be known as Free Medical Aid. And she eventually was released from there, but that was a prelude to what happened later. She was involved in all sorts of other dissident activities, despite the fact that she was, as they say, with child. Somewhere around March, she got baptized. She had a friend named Natasha Trauberg, and Natasha Trauberg is a name, she died last year. It's a name that we probably, not a lot of people know, but among other things, Natasha Trauberg was a translator, primarily from English, other languages as well, and the most important writers that she translated were Woodhouse, P.G. Woodhouse, but also C.S. Lewis and G.K. Chesterton, important Christian writers from a particular tradition. We don't know how much they were being read in Samizdat Pub, but my sense is that Trauberg is one of those people who was very instrumental in revitalizing thinking about Christianity and in shaping that to a considerable extent. She was probably brought up Christian quietly. She and Gurbanyevskaya were and had been friends for some time. Gurbanyevskaya approached her. She was visiting Moscow. She lived in Lithuania. And she told her that she wanted to be baptized. Came out of nowhere. Nobody expected it. People didn't necessarily get baptized. She could have stayed in Moscow. The well-known figures, Alexander Mien, Father Dudko, were there, and they were baptizing all sorts of people and doing it courageously and without worry about the people knew that they wouldn't be turned over to the authorities. Gurbanyevskaya said no. We don't know why, but she wanted to go to Lithuania to be baptized, which she did. They went to an obscure fellow named Atiets Antoni, a monk, and Trauberg was her godmother, answered questions, promised that she was a good person, that she would be a good Christian, the fact that she was there wearing pants, which people didn't do, and probably about 7 or 8 months pregnant, was okay. None of that seemed to matter. A year or so later, she will do the same thing for the poet Dmitry Bobyshev and for a couple of other people as well. So that happens in 68 in Lithuania. So let me take you to a quote from a recent book published by Vladimir Zubov, Zhivago's Children. Some of you may have seen it. It's a great book about that generation, I guess we could say. And here's what he said. Now, there's two words in particular we need to pay attention to. Even, that's one of them, even some of Zhivago's children on the left began to discover Russian Orthodox culture. Starting in the mid-1960s, so that's the other phrase I need you to remember, Muscovite Jews combined their veneration of Alexander Solzhenitsyn and Novy Mir with a keen interest in Holy Russia and its Orthodox tradition. Although many Moscow intellectuals still clung to their communist idealism and continued to read Marx and Lenin, a few others began to feel a strange longing for spiritual values they could not find in the tomes of the materialistic, atheistic revolutionaries. Some urban intellectuals, admirers of Solzhenitsyn, shared his nostalgia for the vanished Russia. And then he goes on. A number of assimilated Jews, to their own amazement, discovered that they shared a fascination with Russian icons and churches, with their anti-Semitic antagonists. One of them, Mikhail Agursky, even traveled to the Russian north, and at Kizhi in particular, to search for his roots, as he put it. This search led Agursky to undergo baptism and embrace Orthodox Christianity. The man who helped him to come to Russian Orthodoxy was Father Alexander Men, end of quote. So the important point here is that he's describing this as a singular and significant phenomenon in the mid-60s, and what I want to point out is that in 55 and 56, some of the members of the Chertkov Circle and Gorbunievsky made the same pilgrimage and were doing the same thing 10 years earlier. And I say that in that way, not for the sake of sort of they were there first or something like that, but that this process, which is considered important for the rediscovery of these values, Christian values, and their ties to old Russia, was definitely happening. I don't know how extensively, but it was definitely happening in the mid-50s. Sergeyev describes it in his memoirs. I've discussed it with he describes one trip on which he went with Chertkov and Krasovitsky. Krasovitsky later became Atyets Stepan, right-wing ultra-nationalist, but he wasn't at the time. And Chertkov never embraced Christianity. Sergeyev, it turns out, was already a Christian, had already read the Bible, and although, as far as I know, he wasn't baptized, he was considered himself a Christian, 55, 56, part of that circle. Gorbunievsky is moving in and out of, and is influenced by their poetry, by the images, and the motifs and the content of their poetry. So Zubov does this. So not really criticizing Zubov, he does a great job of bringing this out, and he clearly isn't aware of the other thing. But there, it is important to draw that back and to realize that where people are coming forth with those things much earlier. So I quickly want to point out a couple of other aspects that of what happens, and everybody knows what happens in 56. What happens in 56? Khrushchev's, that didn't affect them at all. That was really not a significant, they already knew that, they didn't care. There was very little of importance for them. Much more important was Hungary. Hungary was much more important. How did they find out? I mean, the people were, one of the key ways that people found out about what was going on in Hungary was through Yugoslav, Serbian in particular, and Polish newspapers and journals. And the importance of opening up and which had only just started to appear in Moscow in particular, eventually they worked their way across the Soviet Union. So Gorbunievsky, it's at that time, not because of Hungary, but Hungary quickly becomes part of it, learns to read Polish. She tried Serbian, didn't work for her. Polish was going to be her language. They not only get the news about Hungary, but they get the news about all sorts of things, about what else is out there. That's one of the main channels where they discover Western literature, because there's much more available in Polish translation. The Soviet authorities were not controlling its entry into the Soviet Union. So everybody was either learning Polish or trying to learn Polish. Everybody carried Polish journals. They were I don't know what they were the equivalent of, but the hottest thing in town, as was Polish cinema and all sorts of other things. She also reads Polish history. And as we'll see in one of the poems right away, which I'm going to turn to more quickly right away, Polish history becomes an important part of her conceptual world. as well, in particular the Polish history of World War II, what happened in 1944. But she's also exposed to Polish literature and Polish culture, which is Catholic. And even what's being published at the time, there's lots of traces of that in it. I have to mention that she had a number of crises around this time as well, a number of crises-provoking incidents. And one in particular, one of the things that happened with Hungary is a number of people got arrested. A lot of people got arrested, and a lot of people got sent to the Gulag. Her friend Chertkov was sent for 5 years. That's one story. It's an important story. Chertkov, for those of you that haven't heard him, it's really hard to find, one of the most important people in the underground culture of the 50s and 60s and into the 70s. I can't find reference to him in anything published in English. It's an interesting, but we won't go there. Krasavitsky is another one, probably the most important poet of the 50s. Anybody heard of him? Exactly. But I can't tell you that story, although I'd like to. Possibly, arguably, probably, he was a major figure in the 1950s and a major influence on Gorbunievsky's life. Two of her classmates were arrested for distributing leaflets, which they produced in the apartment of perhaps her closest friend at the time. They were sent to prison because she gave evidence against them. So it's a complicated story. It's a delicate story. The fact of that happening tells us a number of things. Tells us, first of all, that people weren't really clear about a lot of things. It's a huge guilt issue for her up until now. It was something that people knew about, but something about something that's important in that sort of dissident movement is that they forgave people to a great extent. They understood that people made mistakes, and so that's part of the story. One can imagine that she carried the need to a search for redemption. Has to be part of what was going on with her, and there were several other crises in her life, let's say, including her first visit to a psychiatric institution towards, she had basically a nervous breakdown, I think, is what we would call it now. So a number of things that made her, I think, intensified whatever she may have been searching for, but I don't know that those are necessarily tied to any of her religious concerns, because I'm going to go right away and try and establish that they were already there in 1956. So, yeah, here we are. Well, this is going to... Oh, I should be pointing that way. Okay. So, there it is. In this poem, Agon v pechi pachti pagas, we have, so remember, this is 1956. This is the Soviet Union. She introduces, in an interesting context, I think, elements of the Day of Judgment, the Last Judgment, and the angel of the Lord in a context which is not necessarily entirely clear, but I suggest if we look at the opening verse, Agon v pechi pachti pagas, chuchut, chuchut, trishat palenia, yesho ne probil pravdy chas, yesho ne smyte prestuplenia. So we have a sense of something that has to be atoned for, something prestuplenia, and it's connected with some version of the Last Judgment. That's presented in the author's voice, right? It's a third-person kind of statement. She takes us through to she repeats in the second verse, references to the Last Judgment again. In the third verse, she introduces the angel of the Lord, and then repeats, but in reverse order, what she said in the first verse, except that the last line, which mirrors the first line, is a completed action. So we had agon v pechi pachti pagas, and here we have хотя огонь уже угас. And so my suggestion is that it's not entirely clear on its own. I think it would be possible to read it politically, but only if we forget about everything else that she writes, both at the time and subsequently. These are images which she takes really out of a so we can talk about the things that have gone unpunished, but there's no reason to relate those to any kind of final or last judgment in the Christian sense. And the dynamic movement we get from the beginning to the end, where we have this thing resolved, I would suggest put it much more in the context of a directive, and I'm prepared to suggest an eschatological context. And we'll see this reappearing. So if it had stopped there, we wouldn't really know what, but those are the images which become the formative components of her poetry as we go through. So the next one, before we get there, in 1961, a short poem entitled Kalakala, Ikupala, we find references to the architectural landscape of old Russia and a reference, clear reference, to a transcendent world. However, there's also a sense of these things, bells and domes, being restricted and perhaps damaged by sinister forces, perhaps reference to restrictions on freedom of belief and practice, and described in a fashion with really significant parallels to her programmatic rejection of and protest against restrictions on artistic freedom in her oldest extant poem from 1956 called Danny Mir. A couple of years later, in a poem called Yavlampu Dolyu Kirasina, this will take a slightly different and more secular form in an evocative address to Russia, an expression which is nationalistic and patriotic in a way at odds at once with Soviet patriotism and with the narrow xenophobic nationalism that was developing in certain circles around the time. Maybe I'll skip to the one that we have up there from 1965. Не сокруши меня, ты господи, не проиграй меня в очко, не прогони бродяги по свету идти, не веря ни во что. So, the first verse would suggest summons images of those two great existentialists of the Old Testament, Job and Abraham, and the questions of what could possibly be understood as capricious undertakings on God's part, and her response to them, similar to those of course they're different, but comparable to Job and Abraham, and the her attempt to situate herself. Or at least her lyrical persona, clearly within that context. In the second verse, ты что по морю яко по суху прошел ступая широко. Of course, we have references to the story of Christ from. I have the actual. It doesn't matter. Where we go? John 6:19-20. There we go. In Matthew 14:25. That's what I wanted to get. And then if we look at if we look at the last verse, ты Боже сын человечий, коли решил на эти плечи ярмо с бубенчиком надеть. Some of you might recognize that line as a modification of a line from Pushkin. And so we have here, first of all, her identification, her clear announcement, which I think is present in a number of earlier poems as well. But here there really can be no doubt that she's situating herself within a Christian context. Secondly, that she's tying her creative function, her function as a poet, to it as well. And she does that both through sort of distinct statements, but also tying it to the specific poetic tradition that Pushkin is a part. In 1966, she published a collection which she entitled Darkness, Темнота. The previous one was called Paradise Lost, a title, she says, which was indicative of her general mood. It's the year that Akhmatova died, and she was very, very close. She probably one of the two or three most important relationships in her life. But most importantly in that collection, we find a large collection of apocalyptic descriptions and references. There's a remarkable poem dedicated to her friend Galanskov, who was languishing in prison. But there is another poem, and I'm worried about running short of time, so I won't quote from it, but в моем родном 20 веке, and где больше, I forget, I won't do it, But most importantly, in Garstochku Vody, she returns to the scene of the Last Judgment, again, this time much more fully developed, and it would seem more frightening scenes of devastation, destruction, despair, degradation everywhere. The implications are frightening and horrible. The conclusion that «Что вам нелегко? Просто страшный суд, просто никого больше не спасут». And in the poem, she has a reference to «И земля пуста» from first and second chapters of Genesis, which represents an interesting juxtaposition of apocalyptic end myth with creation myth. And the circle is underscored by the way that she connects the first verse, similar to what she did in the previous one that I mentioned, with the last, with the 16th. The 16 verses is an enormous and exceptionally long poem on her part. So maybe quickly, there's a from the same period, a poem which should be on, which should be the next one on there. I'm just going to briefly, «Проклятие, счастье», yes, «пишутся слова, как горы движутся, а я как мотылек летаю между строк». And I'm going to come back to a couple of poems where she does something similar, and I think connects with the last poem, so if you can try and sort of keep that in your heads. So here she says, «Я как мотылек летаю между строк», and the very last two lines where she says, «Гуляет между строк вселенный ветерок». So she connects her own voice and this notion of the universe or eternity again in conjunction with her function as a poet. And I'm going to try and tie that to a couple of other poems. So the next one, from 1973, a year or so after she's released from prison, she writes, «Это я не спасла ни Варшаву тогда и ни Прагу потом». Obviously a direct connection with her decision to protest on Red Square in August 1968. And she and the others always described their motivation as being grounded in the need to show the people of Czechoslovakia that not every Soviet citizen supported the invasion, that it would be, somebody had to show them that it wasn't everybody. It was an act not only of individual moral responsibility, but also on behalf of the nation, of not the Soviet Union, but I think Russia. She connects this with the failure of the Soviet Army to assist the rebels in the Warsaw Rebellion in 1944, and this takes us back to that question which she has talked about to me about the importance of what she discovered reading these Polish books about 1944. So this whole question of the connection between individual and collective guilt and responsibility, which she ties, it would appear, in the last two lines, with the lack of godliness within the culture that generates these acts. В закопченном углу, где темно и пьяно и убого, где живет мой народ без вины и без Господа Бога. So there are a number of connections that need to be made there. So if we look at the next one, the vacillation between barely restrained despair, and there is a lot of existential angst in her poetry, and joyful affirmation of the goodness of God's creation, as she sees it, we find in this poem, «Пламя тысячи свечей», this poem built partially on the familiar story of Mary and Joseph's adventures in Bethlehem. I probably shouldn't have phrased it that way, especially Luke chapter 2 and 2 through 7, I guess, the poet expresses and overcomes her doubts about where to find God, aligning her view with the unlikelihood of finding him in the manger. Wiem li, wan li, il nie wiem. And for those of you that don't speak Polish, she's, do I know, is it him, or do I not know? But then finds that miracle providing the basis for seeing the light in all things. В прислонившейся руке, отразившейся в реке, в море, в океане, в небе, в белой соли, в черном хлебе. Which is an interesting way of reflecting that notion of why the manger, as it's traditionally explained in the Christian tradition. And this is something that she will do quite a bit, picking up on the iconic representations of righteousness, goodness, and integrity, klip dasol. In general, the mundane and trivial appear with great frequency. She has this wonderful poem from not long after she arrived in Paris, which she starts out with, Voitana la vie quotidienne, in her poetry. And she has several strategies for moving between that and transcendent notions. She brings together things like poetry and laundry, congealed soup and love, pinball and metaphysics. I have to tell you that this woman who's almost blind, cross-eyed, got kicked out once from university for not being able to pass her phys ed exams as an incredible pinball player. But also one of the key binaries in her work is her embracing of the mundane as an expression of divine goodness. So if we go to the next one, Шёл год недобрых предсказаний. And here we have an incredible litany of horrors, grotesqueries, transgressions of nature, inhumaneness, with no explanation whatsoever, I would suggest. By the way, the cockroaches the size of plums is from Gogol, of course. But all of these things are listed out, and all we get is a sense of what might be the problem. Of course, the problem appears to be attempts to account for these things through earthly means. And she leaves it at that, and only in the context of the other poems where she provides her idea of how they need to be understood do we get a sense of it. But it's, I guess, one of the things that it reminds me of is Ivan's discussion with Alyosha at the beginning, early on in The Brothers Karamazov. And of course, she will, in some of her other poems, give an answer very similar to Alyosha's, or perhaps to the Christ figure in the Legend of the Grand Inquisitor. Very similar, I would say. So, in if какой я I missed one. In Господи, Господи, ночи туман. I don't see my notes, but that's fine. It doesn't matter. Here, this is written on December 13th, 1981. Declaration of martial law in Poland. The action of the poem takes place outside the Polish embassy in Paris, where Gorboniewski was a very notable part of the action. And I'm going to take just one of the things that there's a story that a group of young Poles went to with some black paint to change the sign of the Paris subway station named Stalingrad, and to change it to, they repainted it, Gdańsk, temporarily, out of their frustration. So, the action of the poem takes place then. Gospody, Gospody, noc I tuman, of course, Nacht und Nebel, night and fog, Hitler's directive. She introduces that into the poem. But what does she do as she goes through it? She says, how is it possible that God will allow this to happen? And she says out loud, and I think she's appealing to the Polish tradition, the romantic tradition of messianism, where the Poles saw themselves as being destined to suffer for the rest of Europe, perhaps, and that, of course, was associated with various notions of Christ. And now, so, видно у Господа Бога для них тоже, что сыну нету иных проявлений любви, кроме распятия. I want to say that Gorboniewski is much closer to Norvid than to Mickiewicz. She really doesn't believe in that, but I assume that at this particular moment, which was a moment, her involvement in solidarity was very extensive, and as was her involvement in post solidarity struggles which was recognized while it was happening and beyond. So, if we go to the next one, в какой я завернула лес, the things of the world are not easy to understand. In this poem, she makes use of partial quotes from Psalms 139 and 113 to position herself relative to the things that challenge her equanimity. Here it's worth noting perhaps that her favorite Russian prose writer is Dostoevsky, which I've already mentioned. The moral challenges she refers to are related to those same explanations that I talked to before. So if we look at the very end, look at the second last verse, в какой конец я забрела земли, в какой незнамый край, как дивны, Господи, дела твои, не все, не эта страсть. Ломящиеся сквозь кусты безлиственные напролом, ты, Боже, смотришь с высоты, и мы не смотрим, мы живем. Those last two lines are from the Psalms, of course. And if we don't know that, we might not really understand that she's trying to present perspective of this is the mystery of the way that God works in the world. And to her, it makes perfect sense. All right, so if we go to the next one, «Подосточке, потоненькой, побревнышку, пошпале». So she describes the daunting challenge of maintaining balance in almost a literal sense, because she has all of these things that she's trying to, these images that she describes, which make life so hard, but she transforms the chasm, the abyss, along which or above which she is dangling into a different kind of endlessness. And so it's important that many times where she will use one of the many synonyms for abyss, бездна, anything like that. A lot of times, whereas I think for most of us that would apply, it would imply something negative, something that we're not striving for. For her, and we see this in the end, it's actually her notion of, or her it's an acceptable way of describing a positive eternity. So над бездною висячью, над берег тот не ближний, где нам сияет счастье по ту сторону жизни. So it would be good to be able to work through the images that she deploys there, because they are quite typical of a lot of the ways, a lot of the things she does. She makes a lot of use of a variety of liminal and border images. So, getting quickly towards the end, в ожидании конца, the next one, не толпитесь на пороге. That, of course, comes from the Book of Amos and the Bible of John, or the Gospel of John, sorry. Всем достанутся чертоги в доме нашего отца. And she works through this in some interesting ways. When we get to the third verse, «Шестикрылый номерок от волнения промок, от ладени любого расплывается лилова». She's talking about the tradition in a certain period in the Soviet Union where in some lines people would get numbers recorded on the palm of their hands, and comparing it to people jostling about and being anxious about whether or not there will be room for them in the other world. And I guess, so when she finishes it up with a reference to the Book of Revelations, не толпитесь за чертою, не томитесь, нема тою в доме нашего отца, песни не кончаются. She's not known for having a sense of humor, but she is capable. There are bits of humor, and I think that really is one of the, I think that's pretty clever, actually. And she does it in an interesting way. In the next one, dedicated to Ania Gorskaya, a Polish woman who became sort of her adopted daughter. She's a couple generations younger than her. It's an interesting story. It's part of that whole solidarity story. But at the end of it, among other things, the very last verse, and this is sort of, she's really giving advice to this younger woman here. And when she ends up saying, «Baby, моё, baby, правда есть на небе, прямо к ней иди домой, лесенкой невидимой». Of course, reference to Jacob's ladder. And she uses that image also in a number of her poems. So, in one poem from the last fully collected volume of her poetry called «Чайная роза», which is published in 2006, quickly, «Что же, Боже?» Next one, yes, sorry. «Да все те же суесловия, суета». Мы с тобой едва похожи, ты то-то, я не та. Of course, so she takes the famous line from Ecclesiastes, transforms it, and puts it in a context related to words, and a context related to her as a poet. So, суесловие, in that case, the substitute there. And if we go through and look at но учуя в дух проще, so she's wondering about the extent to which she is capable of doing what is supposed to be the in other words, to what extent is she being as God-like, in other words, is she as a human being resembling the image of God the way that she's supposed to? Is she capable of that? Are her her fallibilities and her frailties coming out that way? Тінню образа подобія я склоняюсь і топчусь, совершаю неподобие на ошибках не учусь. Но учу я... No, it's before that.
Oh, before that.
Yeah,
sorry.
We probably won't do this one, but... unless it got missed, right after this one. Did it get missed? Keep going. This was in order. That's what happened. I wasn't going to... the next, keep going. That's all one. We don't need that. Keep going. Sorry, here we go. And I'm pretty much... So this one, she's struggling with that. So I take you to the last one. This one is maybe published up somewhere on the internet or in a journal, but hasn't published. She has it ready for publication, and she is hopeful it'll come out in the sometime this year, I think. And so quickly, Господи, услыши меня, я тебя не лишняя, слышу Доню. So she actually has God speaking to her in the poem. Не прошу переменить эту дерганую нить, мою долю. Что захочешь, сам подашь, как подал мне карандаш. И тетрадку, Господи, услыши меня, чтоб не вышло из меня беспорядку. So I think, I mentioned the poem at the very, very beginning, there are lots of others where she makes tentative suggestions that her function as a poet is grounded in her religious beliefs, and not just her religious, but is connected with a spiritual principle. I think that's the way I want to say it. And in here, I think this is the most explicit statement of that. I want to suggest that it's stated in a tone or in a register which is very similar to what Ulitskaya said about her in that somewhat cryptic passage that I read from that book about her. And maybe I'll just leave it dangling there. Since most of you probably have never read Karbunievskaya before, all you get to go on is what I've told you.
I'll ask a question. Would it be plausible to suggest that there's quite a significant change in the texture and in either her expression of her religiosity or the way she deploys that imagery? It seemed to me in those first poems from the 50s, especially that first one with the inversion about the fire dying and then the angel saying, too late, kids, fire's out.
All of the embers are still crackling. But.
Yeah. This sense that you get it repeated too a bit in the Russians don't feel guilt and they don't know God, right? But there's a sense of a possibility, at least in the 50s, early 60s, of an Eastern Europe that is still there after an apocalypse, right? And there's this possibility that even somebody who believes or is seeking belief, there's this possibility of being there and abandoned. Whereas by the 70s and 80s, when she gets into immigration, that she embraces religion not just as a source of hope, but as a much more, not just a critical, but a much more integral and positive, I don't mean normative, but just a positive way of apprehending and interpreting the world. She's probably a lot better versed in Christian texts as well by that time.
Okay, so let me...
I'm just saying there's a trajectory from... It starts off as a dimly apprehended belief based, but it's more despairing. And then it becomes much more textually grounded in form, but also a much more powerful and embracing worldview.
I'm not sure that it takes as long as you think it did, mm-hmm. does. So I think she's well on her way to being there, late 60s.
Yeah. Okay. No,
so it isn't a function of exclusively. I mean, things change, things develop, but not she doesn't need to leave the Soviet Union. There are some important breaks in the. In the textology, we have only a few of her poems. Well, we have the other ones, but she considers them to not exist before. Most of the poems she wrote between about 54 and 62. She occasionally calls them destroyed, other times calls them disposed of. And some of what you say would, I think, be supported quite well by those poems. But there are other things. There are some things working against it as well. But I think, in general, the line is right. What I didn't get to talk about was that the Krasavitsky, in particular, but also Chirkov, and I think to a certain extent Sergeyev—they're the three main figures in that group. They were the only ones writing. They're a little more senior than her. Comments on their work suggested that no one thought at all in the mid-50s in the Soviet Union about atomic destruction, for example, destruction, but they did. So they had a sense of the possibility, of a real possibility of an end-of-time scenario, and they're both interested in metaphysical questions and in these sort of end-of-time questions, as well as really operating completely out of a Soviet context. Their poetry there's no point of, might be slightly overstated, but not much. That doesn't affect them because they're not worried about getting published. They write for themselves, for each other, for a larger community. So she picks some of that up from them. But I think some of your observations, if we had, and out of loyalty to her, I think those early poems are really informative about her development. Of her ideas and her poetic technique and all sorts of other things, but what do you do? It's an ontological problem. It's a personal problem. It's a moral problem. She says they don't exist. I have copies.
One follow-up question. And begs to be an interesting test for the argument about the dominance of the religious perspective. Her reactions to 89 in Poland, Eastern Europe, 91 in the former Soyuz, and then what happens to Russia during the 90s, not so much more recently, but does she use these as occasions for poetic reflection?
Very little.
Interesting.
And I used some examples, but there really is relatively little, more than relatively, not much explicit political content at all in her poems. There's really very little. Her most famous poem from the 60s is Concert for Orchestra, Concertla Orchestra, which was mislabeled by most people because they didn't realize that Bartók wrote something called Concert для Orchestra. There is a political subtext to it, but it's much more about the artistic spirit. And it's the way that the artistic spirit is located and is problematized within the political context but she doesn't make those explicit ties, and it's the same with the things that you're talking about. Now in her the writing she was doing of Ruskaya Moysol and things like that, then there's all sorts of it. How she's an astute political commentator, but her political opinions are sometimes a little bit tricky. By the way, I didn't mention she translated stuff, papal encyclicals and stuff like that. She and some of her friends in Paris were great fans of that pope, for a number of not surprising reasons, I think.
It's interesting when we talk about her as a religious poet. So in this poem, for example, it's very the religion is very much a personal aspect, whereas other places it's kind of a national aspect. When you're talking about you just mentioned it in your comments about the domes and about the landscape.
Yeah, I did the
Russian daily life, that sort of thing. How does like the national aspect of Orthodoxy and like the personal religious aspect? How does she mix those?
I don't think that I've got a grasp on it fully because she's difficult. First of all, she's not baptized in the Moscow Patriarchate in the Russian Orthodox Church. She's in the when she was baptized, she was already had rejected that version. So there's a break there.
It's the
church associated with the Russian student Christian movement in the West, right? So the Ruski Pravoslavy.
Christian church abroad.
Yeah, but there's a subgroup of it. Yeah, and so she dissociates herself from that. But for she is, I guess I would say, I'll try to say it this way: she is a Russian cultural nationalist in the sense of embracing the traditional Russian values, except for the xenophobia. Does that make sense? Okay, one of her close friends, some of you probably may know Valentin Nepomniachtchi, hugely important now as a Pushkin scholar. They were very close. They went to school together. Huge correspondence between the two of them. They were probably best friends for quite a while, and there's no trace of that in him. But now that's his version of his. He's got the Russian nationalism with the walls around it, and she doesn't. So I think so. That partly answers your question, I think. It's a difficult thing to link, but if you look at her, what she does in Novaya Polsha, the heritage, the legacy of Jerzy Giedroyc, Herling Grudzinski, and Szwaniewicz, and these people, is to try and build cultural and political bridges between the countries of what they call the borderlands between Poland and Russia, and to make that a fluid cultural territory, the BLU as they call it, and so she is. She's not always good at it, but she is all about trying to share, to open up and share. So, wouldn't always necessarily appear that way. Sometimes we'll go down.
I'd like to ask a question about the poem "Какой я завернул в лес." I should tell you there are a group of students here who did read that poem.
So they have. Okay, good.
We didn't do the justice that we should have in the time allotted in class, but if you could say a little bit more about that final line where there seems to be this contrast being set up, «Мой не смотрю, мой живем». When we read that, and I didn't realize that this was from the Psalms, what meaning does that have in the Psalms? Because kind of the consensus that we came to in class was it was signaling a divide between humanity and the divine.
I think maybe there's some people who are... I don't really come from a religious background, so there's but I think that the exegetic sort of take on it is that God knows, and we accept that God knows.
Could you repeat please which song that was? It was 139. Did you say?
139 and 113, I think. And I think that's what my stuff's all out of order here. The Russian version is, and I don't know, but I think the Russian version is one number off of the English. That's right. Okay, so that. Okay, in those two psalms, it's I think it's 113 and 139. I think that's the short answer to it. That the idea, and she has that in one of the other ones as well. The idea is that God knows and that God will take care of us, and so the fact that we don't understand. The fact that we see this, and when we have it, it's that typical plaintive cry, it could be seen by some as a kind of quietism, presumably, to just accept. But of course, it's an active engagement with of that acceptance. It's an active process of faith, I guess. Does that make sense?
I'm still mulling it over because the verb "jivyon," they're not saying we don't watch, we believe or we accept, but we live, and life is always messy and full of error and sin.
And we live and we go on and we have these struggles and these problems, and we see all of these things that she lists, these horrible things in some places, but as the Psalm tells us, as Ecclesiastes tell us, as these other wisdom books tell us, God knows. And God will. God will take care of us. That's supposed to be coming from her voice, not mine.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, so I have a sort of more abstract question, and that is, I was really struck when you said that none of her poems are expressly political, and that pertains to her whole career.
Yeah, no, I mean, I probably get busted on none, but very few.
Okay, well, and I'm not an expert at all. So I was wondering, though, so in your account of her and her life and her background, which seems to inform, to some extent, your interpretation of her poems, so much of that background and so much of what she's known for is her dissident activity and her political activism. So it's really striking that her poetry can be so divorced from what she's very well known for in this whole other realm.
And
how do you deal with that as an analyst? Like, how are you able to, on the one hand, have to master her life and her background and her experiences in order to interpret the policy, her poetry, and at the same time try to bracket that in the process of.
So, I'll raise three things. First one, I think I've already lost what one of them was. First one, when I started this part of a much larger project, I'm trying to write a biography, and I didn't know much about her when I started, and that's one of the big problems, is we have these, to identify the strands, and to be able to see them separately and to see how they are intertwined, but to untwine them as well, to perform that, and it's really hard. Then I can tell you that she's not very helpful. She's very helpful in a lot of ways, but for her, these things aren't problems. And that's kind of, okay, so that's part of it. Article I published in NLO a couple years ago now is precisely about that. And so my thesis was that in her early poetry, despite these things going on, and I went from basically from 56 to when she got out of prison. I didn't try to take it past 72. Made the case that that basically her voice is a lyrical voice, and that the content of those poems, even some of the ones that like. The one that's popularly known as Bartok, even that one, really, it's to try to use that to explain late thaw cultural policies. It does speak to that, but what it says about artistic freedom and about her investment in it and her commitment to it and her need for it and all sorts of other things like that is what it really expresses. So there's one of the early poems, Dan Nimir, which is a very interesting poem. And she has an image in there which makes the Iron Curtain appear to be a wooden fence. But it's, again, there are other things as well, but just pick on that one connects with it. It really is about her search for artistic freedom, and it's taken outside, similar to what I suggested. I certainly didn't make the case, but what I suggested, that groups like the Chertkov Circle, and I think that's true of the group around Akhmatova as well, they were, Bobyshev, Brodsky, it didn't matter what Khrushchev, what particular, might have affected whether they get arrested or not, but it didn't affect how they saw their art. Their art was not conditioned in that sense by what was going on around them. Does that make sense? I mean, is it to at least address the question? So I guess maybe I can pat myself on the back. She read the article. I didn't tell her that I was doing it, and she thought it worked. But she may just have thought it was well written and not agreed with the content. But she generally doesn't say she's. Pretty much, she's pretty given to telling the truth, sometimes painfully. So the question about it ties in directly to what you said about what you were asking about when things change. She was very close friends with Adam Michnik, who was leader of the Solidarity Movement. When the Solidarity Movement decided that they could work with the Communist Party, that fateful moment in the early 90s, it was the first time she saw Michnik. She went up to him and. Basically, they never talked again after that. I mean, she says what she thinks for the moment. She's mellowed a bit. Since 91, she was known to be very unmellow. She made everybody cry at Ruska and Moisel. I'm telling stories now, but that's the story. She's demanding of.